Welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is July 12th, 2006. Today's session is titled Gazing at Strengths, presented by Steve Van Bockren. The number is VB-S-2006-02. Let's listen in.
Or thumbs down. As to whether or not, as human beings, we were born with an original blessing or with an original sin. Let's see, how can I ask that? How many of you think we were born with an original sin? Sinful creatures. Isn't that part of, at least part of my belief? You're not sure, though.
Capacity.
Capacity. Can have an hour. Just what does your question mean?
Yeah. You're a little nervous about that. Oh, well, likewise, how many of you think you were born with an original blessing? Born with both? Yeah. And it's kind of a complex issue, but we're going to explore that just a little bit today. Don't worry about the writing that you can't see, but this is just the classic picture of an old woman and a young woman, and most of you have seen it before. Anybody not? It's okay if you haven't. Paul, you've not seen this before. When you look at that picture, what do you see?
Well, I see them both now. So.
Okay, all right. But originally...
There's 14 people to explain it to me, though.
All right. How many of you only see the old woman? Only see the old woman.
That's all I see. Right?
Okay. Is it George? Or yes. Yeah, George. George only sees the old woman. How many of you only see the young one?
Well, that's until someone pointed out to me.
Yeah, that's the first thing.
All right.
Yeah, so I said the old one first.
All right. Now, do any of you have any doubts that when I tell you that there's both an old woman and a young woman in that same picture? You wouldn't argue with me, would you? Because you're healthy, emotionally intelligent adults, so you understand life is perceived in multiple perspectives. In fact, our brains are designed to perceive things differently. Most of us in here, for example, don't pick up all of the details that are going on right now. You'd be in overload, and you'd be in real trouble. If everything that was going on, including the sounds, the little cough you just heard, I picked that up. But if everything that was going on, your brain picked that up, you'd be in trouble. So we have a brain that sort of picks out and decides what it is we'll pay attention to. Now, there's a number of kids, and I'm going to introduce you to one a little bit later, that pays attention to everything. Just everything. He notices everything. And it's a real problem for him in a classroom setting. And I'll say more about that in a little bit. But... just keep that picture in mind as we go through some of the stories that I have to share with you. And I'm going to try to engage you in conversations about how it is that we decide as human beings what we are going to pay attention to, particularly when it comes to behavior that's outside of our circle that we would normally like or appreciate. So, let's go ahead and move forward here. Any of you heard of the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual? How do you know of that?
I know about ADHD diagnosis.
Oh, okay. So a daughter has been diagnosed, and what the psychiatrist and psychologist will do is go to this manual that has increased when it first began from about 120 different diagnosable mental health issues, mental illnesses. It's now grown to about 360. And at any particular time, most of us in here could be diagnosed with one of those conditions. We just keep finding more and more deficits and problems with the human being all the time. Well, there's this whole movement going on now that's been termed the resiliency movement, that's looking at our strengths and our virtues. The questions that are being asked now are, why are some kids, some adults, with multiple adversities placed on their shoulders, able to get through those and do okay? What do they have that others maybe don't have? See, in the past, we've always looked at the problems. And at one time, for example, this little guy, you know, we would look at him as a problem. At least schools did. Because he didn't fit the general mold. You know, he looked different. He talked different. He didn't have the same intelligence. And so for a long time, our schools just kept kids like Jeffy out of there and felt okay about it because he wasn't part of the circle. You know, he didn't fit the way we thought he should. Now, there was important legislation that was passed way back in the early 70s that said a kid like this should have the right to go to school. And I doubt if there's anybody in here now that would argue with Public Law 94-142 that says that a kid even with Down syndrome should be allowed to go to school. So our mind, our thinking about a boy like this has shifted because of really national legislation, the federal government getting involved. So sometimes when the federal government gets involved, good things do happen. Now, it's easy for us today to include this kid in our circles, right? No problem. But how about a guy like this?
More trouble with that.
What's that?
More trouble with that.
Yeah. Would you want him in your son's classroom?
He already is.
He is my son. So, when you take a look at a picture like this, what sort of things come out of your head?
Anger.
Okay.
I think more of parenting, that there's no one around. Mm-hmm.
No borders.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that. I think this kid may have, and it's because I volunteer at a school for kids with learning disabilities, this kid may have some neurological problem that makes it difficult for him to identify what's appropriate. And that's not the parent's fault. Mm-hmm.
So there could be neurological issues going on. Uh-huh. But it could be parenting issues. Could it be he just has a sore finger? Jeannie says, no, that's not it.
Not from the look on his face.
Four sore fingers.
Say what?
Four sore fingers, because they're down.
Well, you see the emblem on his shirt, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the trucker thing for the ladies, isn't it?
Now, I have this slide in backwards because if you could see the name, then you'd recognize the soccer team that that Blazer represents.
Oh, that's the brand?
In some ways, he's doing what all kids do. He's modeling adult behavior. I mean, that would be another perspective. I'm not sure if I'm right here. But in this social setting, in this context, and we've been looking at reading the Bible in context. And this morning, Bob talked about the fact that when you're reading the Bible, you know, there's really three important things you have to always think about. Context, context, and context. And in this context, maybe this kid is just fitting right in and doing what all the adults around him are doing and really is passionate about this game that's going on. And maybe he's not a troubled kid at all. Who knows? All right.
He must have lost,
yeah. The work that I'm involved with, called Reclaiming Youth International, oftentimes will deal with kids that have been placed outside of the circle because of behavior. And And oftentimes you know when behavior is such that you want to exclude people. When something inside of you causes you to make a sound, a turn of your body, opening of the eyes, there's something in you that is a little unsettled, and it comes out in some sort of a physical movement. And you know then that some sort of value is involved. So when you saw that picture, even the giggle for some of you, a little bit of laugh, would be an indication that something of value is going on inside of you. And I'm not suggesting that you tolerate that behavior. But I do know that professionals that don't learn to tolerate that behavior and work with the child for a period of time end up having no influence with the child. Those that say, if you act like that, you're out of here. That's it. I don't want anything to do with you. And it's hard, because I was raised not to do that, not to even look with a broader perspective on that. I was taught to be very judgmental of something like that. And so it took me a long time to kind of work myself through having kids do that, say those sort of words, and not put them away. And it's difficult. Our former governor of South Dakota, Bill Janklow, at a Rotary Club meeting, when he was asked about the kind of language that is happening in our schools today, he suggested that what needed to be done was to respond the way he would. And he said, this is what I would do. If I were in a school and I heard that kind of language, I would turn real quickly, and my elbow would happen to catch the kid in the mouth, and then I'd pick the bloody kid up and say, you know, when you talk that way, that just startled me so much. You can't do that. And then brush him off and send him on his way. And everybody in the audience, you know, applauded. Because we have this mentality that the way you fix something like that is to provide more pain. And you up the ante until it gets so painful, kids finally say, no, I'm not going to do it. But oftentimes for kids, that's not the way things work. I later wrote the governor, kind of knew him, and suggested to him that there might be a different way, because this really, you know, was splashed all over the news. And people asked, well, what'd you tell him he should have done? And I said, well, all you can really do is go to a young man like that and say, son, we expect greater things from you. We expect a different kind of language in here. And then just walk away. Well, yeah, as soon as you walk away, the kid's going to flip you the bird or say something behind your back. And kids will think about that stuff. I was surprised I only got just a simple letter back from the governor. I also explained to him that, you know, my dad was a decorated World War II vet. Battlefield commission guy, and never spanked any of his kids, and was never mean toward any of us. And he wrote back and said, well, we all have different experiences in life. And he was one of those kids that at an early age ended up going to the Marines, and for him, it sort of set his life on a different course. But, you know, I'm not sure if it ever really took the bully out of him. You know, he was our representative when he ran a stoplight in South Dakota, because he talks about the fact that Bill Janklow, and that's the way he talks about himself, needs to get to places quickly. And yeah, sometimes I have a lead foot and I blow through stop signs, and he bragged about that. Well, he hit a guy on a motorcycle and killed him, and ended up getting 100 days, and a lot of that was released from the prison. And I share that with you because I think it says something about our system too, and how it is that we tend to treat folks that have money and ability to defend themselves compared to those that don't. So I've hinted to this in some of my other presentations, how in my world of special education, we have all sorts of D words as a way to talk about difficult kids. And if you just take a look at the labels on the right side, that little boy you just saw in the previous picture could be labeled disobedient if you were a parent. In education, we call him disruptive, special ed, he's disabled, social work, dysfunctional, juvenile justice, delinquent. In medicine, we might call him a diseased kid. Behaviorism, he's a disruptive boy. Psychodynamics, that's, you know, the Freudian perspective. That's a kid that's disturbed. In sociology, he might be deprived. And in folk religion, we might even say he's demonic. And at one time, of course, we ended up burning people at the stake for behavior that was outside of our circles. They scared us, and we thought they were possessed, so let's get rid of them. But, you know, this resiliency movement and a different perspective is now available to us. And here are some of the words now we're starting to see show up in the literature. And just like the old woman and the young woman in the picture, or taking a look at that Down syndrome kid, what words do you want to use? What perspective do you want to take in looking at these young people that, in my mind, many of them are hurting in one way or another? There are those, again, that aren't necessarily hurting, but have some neurological damage, or their brain, I don't even want to call it damaged always, because, you know, when you look at the wiring in our brain, I mean, it's much, much, much more sophisticated and complicated than what's in a 747. And sometimes that wiring gets disorganized or organized in such a way that kids end up thinking and doing in ways that are outside of the norm. Alright, so let's go ahead, Sarah, and let's keep going here. And let me tell you about this kid. And just have some stories, and then at any point you just interject with your questions and comments. And let me tell you about Howard. This is his picture when he was 17 years old. And go ahead, we'll hit the next one. And one more. And you'll see the picture's a little bit different in that he has a prison tag on him down below. When he was 17, he was on his way from Chicago with a buddy, and they stole a gun from grandma, and they ended up out in South Dakota, and they ran out of money. What money they had, they spent on fancy hotels, lots of food, and they decided what they needed to do was to get some money. So they hatched this plan that they would get out into the country, flag down a car. Howard purchased a ball peen hammer from a local hardware store, put that in his pants, and his friend had the gun in his pocket. And they flagged down this South Dakota teacher. And the teacher pulled over, picked them up. Howard's in the back seat. And the other guy's in the front seat. And as they're tooling down the road, George takes out the gun and points it at this teacher. And says, pull over, give us your money and your car. And she was feisty and said, no. He shot her. And the bullet went through her arm and out her shoulder. She was able to pull the car over, got out of the car, and ran down the road. George took after her and shot her again. They put her in the back seat of this car and put a blanket over the top of her. Now, both boys are in the front seat. George is driving. Howard's hanging over the back seat because Ada kept trying to sit up. And Howard told me that he hit her 32 different times. Not so hard to kill her because he didn't want to kill her, he said, but to keep her quiet. And as they were driving down the road, it ended up that George didn't know how to drive. These are two boys from Chicago. Rolled the car in the ditch, and they took off and ran. Found themselves behind a haystack and were smoking cigarettes, wondering what to do. There was a traveling sales guy that kind of saw the car roll in the ditch and the boys take off. He found Ada, got her to the hospital, where she drifted in and out of consciousness. The sheriff put out one of those all points bulletin, you know, and all these farmers show up with their shotguns, and one guy thinks they might be behind this haystack and yells out, "Put your hands up." The guys didn't know it. They took off and ran. The guy shot above them and stopped, and he hauled them into town, and they just about lynched the two guys before they got into the jail. They brought them over, and Ada was able to identify them before she died. And when I met Howard, he had the distinction, you might have to hit it again, one more time, that, as having served the longest amount of time in prison of anybody in the United States, over 76 years, 57 years. The longest amount of time. And anyhow, we had a lot of, I was interested in what had happened to this guy. And because at that time I was trying to understand our system of building prisons and putting people away and trying to understand if that made sense. And one of the things that I did was talk to Ada's sister, the only surviving member. And Ada's sister was so angry governor for releasing him to a nursing home. But the guy was getting to be a fire hazard. When he'd smoke, you know, the ashes would fall on his doctors, and they were afraid he was going to burn up the place. And so I was just curious about studying that whole issue of how retribution, you know, punishing people, how effective that is. And it seemed to me that it was important to talk to the victim. And the only one, again, that was left was Ada, Ada's sister. And she was bitter. And she said, my folks died young because they were still mad and had died with a sense of loss and grief, and there was no healing there. And she wanted, if it would have been possible, she said, "I'd throw the switch." And so, I mean, her heart was still really, really tender, really broken from what had happened. But anyhow, that kind of got me into that one piece of studying this whole issue about what do we do with kids that end up hurting others and hurting the system? Does it make sense, in a sense, to lock them up and throw away the key? I don't think so. I think there are better ways. Jump in if you have any questions. I'm going to just run through a number of stories here rather quickly, and then we'll get to some ideas. This was a young woman from Seattle, Washington, that I met when she was 16 years old. This is her 14-year picture. And Nikki said I could share this with people. When I met her, she was sitting in the county jail in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the attorney asked me to visit with her because she was facing up to 7 years in the South Dakota Women's Penitentiary. She was on her way from Seattle out to the East Coast when she ran out of money in Sioux Falls. And she ended up hooking up with a couple of older, younger people, 21, 24 years old. And they ended up camping down by the river. They jumped a guy that was walking by and robbed him of 3 cents. That's all they had on him. But they beat him pretty badly. And Nikki was part of that. She was holding a kitty in one hand while she took a 6-inch stick and she flicked the guy's broken, bloody nose back and forth. And she said, "You're in my hell now." And that was all part of the court documentation. Well, the attorney didn't want to visit with her because he said every other word was the F word. Plus, she would sit on the back of her chair and kind of rub.
head and rolled eyes. And Sonny said, the attorney, would you talk to her? I said, sure. And part of my work was just to help with her defense, to try to keep her in the juvenile system instead of bumping her up into the adult system. Because I think at that age, even though our juvenile system was in a mess, there was a better chance for her to get some help. Our prison systems are not designed to help, to give new skills, to provide emotional support, to help understand a life that was left that might have been abusive. We do very, very little of that in our prisons today. It varies from state to state, but in South Dakota, it's nil. It's just all sit in your cell, you come out, walk around a recreation yard. It's all about punishment. We're going to fix you by making you never want to do that again. So we want to make this so awful for you. Well, one of the ways, I guess this was the paper clipping, and this is where I met her at 16, but she turned 17 while she was in the courthouse. But anyhow, she was not put in the juvenile prison, but was sent off to the adult prison for 7 years for participating in that. And when I talked to Nikki, she was then just beginning to learn how to draw, and she liked to draw, and had some time in her room. And I said, would you draw for me a little bit about what your life was like in Seattle? And this was the first picture she gave me. What are some things that you notice?
The swastika?
Yeah.
Chimes.
She said she had about a fingerful of Native in her. And she was proud of that, but she didn't quite know what to do with it. And so she was very much into this Aryan race stuff. She thought her life would have been better had she not had that fingerful of Native in her. And so we talked through that quite a bit. Other things you notice? What's that? Yeah. She lived on the streets in Seattle. So she was in the alley with her crew, another name for gang. And Nikki said she didn't prostitute herself or sell drugs, but her job was to take care of the babies of the older gang or crew members. She said she did that really quite well. And they trusted her with the babies. So that was her work. Way in the back, you notice something?
She's sitting on a box labeled fragile.
Yeah. Uh-huh. She understands that part about it, but look at her. I mean, half her hair is shaved, and you know, she's got the leather. And I asked her, and I knew, what's that look all about, Nikki? And she would say, well, when you're walking down the street and you've got people walking down the same way, guess what? They get off the street and go to the other side. Why would a kid need to do that? Well, as Nikki got to know me and I learned her story, she was first raped when she was 8 years old. And she said, I ended up running into the river because I knew those boys would chase me into the river again. And then there's one horror story like that after another. And she said when she was 13, that's when she realized she was bigger than her mom. And she grabbed the belt away from her mom and wrapped it around her own hand and went after her mother. And she said, at that point, I knew one of us needed to be out of the house. The kids that I've met that live on the street don't choose to be there in one sense. For a lot of them, there can be so much pain at home that it's easier to live on the streets, to get away from all of that. So the look was a protective factor for them. And even her talk and her rough language became kind of a protective factor for her. At one point, she asked me if I'd arm wrestle her. You don't think I'm very tough, do you, Steve? I said, no, I didn't say that. I said, you look like you're tough. You want to arm wrestle me? I said, no, I don't want to arm wrestle you. Finally, she convinced me we had fun. I was tougher. Yeah, thanks, Dad. But very fragile kid. You'll notice the syringe and the the bottles and stuff. She did just about every kind of drug you can imagine. And went through a period of time where she doesn't even remember what she was on. She was just so far gone.
Down at the bottom where it says the lost kids. In the left. The lost kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And Bulldog, Wild Card, Casper, some of those other names are all people that are part of her crew. Mm-hmm. A number of them are dead now. Yeah. Any strengths in that kid?
That she took care of some young children.
Mm-hmm.
That's a strength.
That is a strength. Can you see any others?
She can draw.
She can draw.
She survived. She's
a survivor.
She knew she had to leave home
mm-hmm.
when she could overpower her mother.
Mm-hmm. She determined that she needed to set some boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is everything perfect for this kid? And is she the sort of kid you'd bring into your house? And more on that in just a little bit. But let's go to the next slide. We wrote quite a bit while she was in prison, and you can see her drawings got better. But
yeah.
The story she would tell me of the things that went on in prison just would break your heart. One time she was sitting on a bed with her co-inmate. Well, she got written up for that, and 30 days in the hole. Why? Because inmates aren't allowed on the same bed with one another. There's always a sexual connotation. And that wasn't a part of Nikki, but so she ends up being isolated for 30 days for comforting another woman in herself. Well, when Nikki got out, she didn't know where to go. She had no place to go. Her dad and mom didn't want anything to do with her. In fact, she lost track of her mother. And she decided to stay in Sioux Falls. But she knew if she went to a halfway house, she'd be in real trouble. Because there's lots of folks there that are trying to heal and overcome past difficulties. And she was just afraid she would end up with someone that would get her back on the old trail. So she was real smart that way. So I approached my church, a rather large church in Sioux Falls, and asked if we could put in the bulletin an announcement that this young woman needed some help, needed a place to stay for a while. And it wasn't in the cards for me at the time to take her in. And it was interesting, the church's response. Well, I don't know, Steve. If we put this announcement in, we're going to have to put in all sorts of other announcements. Where's it all going to end? And I understand that. I mean, there are boundaries that churches even have to place. But it just struck me as kind of peculiar that someone that really needed help and just looking for someone that might jump in. And by golly, if we didn't find a psychologist and a social worker whose kids had just kind of left the nest and they were excited about helping out. And so Nikki ended up living with them for about 6 months. And then we ended up surrounding this kid because when she came out, she was only 20, maybe 21. And it's crazy the way we think that, you know, when you get to 18, you're now an adult and you can take care of yourself. Silly. It's silly thinking. Those of us that have kids that are older than 18. Yeah. 50. Yeah. I tell folks I still run back to my mother every once in a while, you know, and get some advice, you know, some counseling, some help to get ground, get some food in me, whatever it might be. And we know from the research, too, that Hertz and Avis and some of the rental car companies, they do have it right. Because they'll only rent to a kid that's 24 or older. Because the statistics are that under that age, there are real risks. We know from the brain research that our executive centers really don't kick in until we're about 24, 25 years old. That's why all of us in here that are older than that, we think back to those days, and we wonder how in the world we got through those days, because we did some very silly things. That doesn't give you permission, you young folks. We want you to grow up. But it is amazing to me, too, that we send our 18, 19-year-olds off to fight our road sports. It's too bad we don't have a rule that only 50-year-olds can fight battles. And then make them gray-haired and grandmothers. Make them our warriors. I think we'd get things figured out without having to fight one another. So anyhow, Nikki, I don't know, you guys, if she's going to make it or not. We'll go to the next slide. Hard to see, but there she is. She's put on a little weight after she had her first baby. And there's her husband, Ron, who was a convicted felon, 40 years old, you know. But he's got full-time work. They're working at it, you know. They're trying as hard as they can. And luckily, we do have the system of people that are kind of looking out for them. It surprised me following Nikki around and trying to get things organized for her, how difficult the system is for a kid like that to make it work. For example, I was with her when she first visited with her parole officer. The parole officer said, you have to go down and get, you have to check in with and have them do a little psychological makeup on you. You have to do that in the first couple of weeks. Well, that meant she had to figure out the bus schedule and how to get down there. And it would have been easy for me to simply run and pick her up and bring her there, but I knew she needed to figure out how to work the bus schedule. She said, believe me, that's no problem. I can do it in Seattle. I can do it in a little podunk town. Anyhow, she asked the question, will it cost me any money when I get there? No, it won't. This is something the state will provide for you. I told her I would join her. I wanted to sit in and see what the process was like. So I get there as she's talking to the secretary, and the secretary is doing one of these, you have to have the $20 or you're not allowed to take that little test. And Nikki is, you know, about ready to jump over the counter, and she's saying, but I was told it wouldn't cost me $20. Well, then I walk in, and I've got a tie on that day, and I said, could I be of help here? Oh, sir, how could I help you? I mean, her voice and language all changed immediately because she was now looking at someone that looked more like her and knew how to play the game. And I said, I overheard the conversation that it takes $20. I was told, and I heard it. Well, if that's the case, then I guess maybe we'll just allow her to go through. Now, had I not been there, Nikki said, you know what would have happened? It would have been 2 weeks later before I would have gotten another appointment. And then I would have had to do this all over again. She told me that for a lot of the young women, it's easier to do the time in the prison than to go through all of these steps to kind of get yourself on the right road. I didn't believe her. But then I saw stuff like that and what it took for her to get her Social Security card, her driver's license. It was painful. It was hard work. Now again, will it work? I'm not sure. One story I have to tell you about Nikki, and she was doing an AA meeting, and there was a thunderstorm in South Dakota, and her ride didn't show up to get her, so she gave me a call. And she looked quite a bit different. She was real heavy at that point, but she had this big white poofy hair. And Nikki is one of those, she'll put herself in these little tight bra straps, you know, and she just lets it all hang out. And she'll wear these big heels and everything. And so anyhow, she calls me and says, you know, it's about 9 o'clock at night. And I said, where can I get you to bring you back to your apartment? She said, I'm down by the Milky Way, which is sort of like a Dairy Queen in Sioux Falls. So I jump into my little red Mustang. And I go down there, and here are all these people at this Milky Way milling around getting their ice cream cones. And here's Nikki and her big white poofy hair. And she doesn't have a lot of social skills. So when I drive up, she squeals, Steve! And she comes bouncing over to me, you know. And all these people are looking at me. This 50-some guy picking up this young woman with this poofy hair. She puts me into all sorts of difficult situations. But she shows up for my class every semester and talks to my kids and keeps them mesmerized. Very articulate, very bright, very capable. But she's got some struggles. She's got some neurological stuff going on, and with the drugs that she took, she's going to struggle. Yes, comment.
You must trust her and not feel at risk of being, you know, falsely accused or something.
Yeah.
I mean, not take someone with you.
Yeah, I you know, I put myself in precarious positions at times, like picking her up like that, but I do trust her. You know, we've developed a relationship where, I don't worry about that. Mm. But I wouldn't advise that to people, right away. But that developed over a period of years. Mm. We have a lot of work to do. When she introduced me to her baby, she said, "Steve, I want to introduce you to Satan One." "Nikki, I can't talk about your baby that way." "Oh, I know, I'm just..." But I said, you know, even saying it in a teasing way, you know, it's difficult. And I just don't want to paint this rosy picture. All of these kids that I end up working with, I've never had kind of one of these Hollywood endings yet, you know. I wish I'd get there. But okay, let's go to this next story. Very quickly, we ended up working with some kids that participated in a juvenile riot in South Dakota, and all of the kids were labeled with mental illnesses, and yet we were locking them away for extended periods of time. 60 Minutes actually came out and did a story on the kids and interviewed us, and we probably don't remember the story at all, but the one that I ended up working with is Mick Anderson up in the top right there. We'll go to the next slide. And Nick was one of those kids that was raised in a violent family. And however, not all kids become violent when they're raised in violent families. Now, his dad knocked him around, his stepdad knocked him around a lot. But what Nick ended up doing is taking the violence out on himself. And he was a cutter. He was a kid that would take broken glass, throw it in his mouth, and chew it. One of the times that I saw him, he was sitting in a Sioux Falls hospital because he had eaten two pencils, two toothbrushes, a bottle of aspirin, and had broken glass and swallowed that. And he just needed to get out of the prison cell, he said, and that was one way to get out. So they had to, you know, take all of that out of his stomach and stuff. We know that. Well, with Nick, I mean, the pictures he drew me really illustrate kind of this dark side of this life that he lived. I think, you know, I'm running out of time. It'd be fun to really kind of deconstruct this kid's story. This was just a guard's report on how Nick at one time put a noose around his neck and tried to hang himself. And tried to do that a number of times while he was in the prison. We'll go ahead. With all of these boys, we had found placements for them to get them some real help. But Nick turned 18 before we could get him off to his placement in Illinois. And once you turn 18, the system kind of closes down on our kids because they're now treated as adults. So we were in a different position. And it was around Christmas time, and Nick wanted to get out of there so badly that he ends up jumping a 24-year-old guard. And he had taken his Vic razor, popped off the top, and sharpened that up on the brick wall, and he put this to that young guard's throat. And I said, "Well, Nick, where were you thinking of going?" Well, at this point, again, this kid has mental health issues. He's really, not thinking clearly at all. His plan was to go to Minneapolis hitchhike to Minneapolis, hook up with this girl he met about 6 years ago. He thinks she's living in Minneapolis. Work at a gas station, make enough money so he could take a plane down to Columbia, make lots of money in the drug cartel, and then build a big house so his mother could come and visit him now and then. I mean, he's hurt. We'll go ahead. But lots of strengths in this kid. And nurtured in a different environment with a different set of helps in place, there's no doubt that this kid could be sitting among us right now and be doing probably okay. We'll go on. Let's keep moving here. One last story, all right? And this brings it into the school realm. Here's a kindergarten teacher, and we'll call her Teacher A, and she's working with this five-year-old kid. And after 9 weeks, this is this boy's report card. He needs improvement in everything, on reading, relating letters and sounds, way he comprehends, knowledge of print structure. This boy was at the point where they had to hire a full-time aide to follow him around, out on the playground, because he was spitting at kids, he was pulling his pants down, he was mumbling, he was swearing. He would take his shoes and pull them off, throw him in the classroom, take his coat off, whip it around, throw that in the classroom. They were at the point where they were ready to send this five-year-old boy off. They didn't know what to do other than to take him out of that classroom and maybe try him in a different classroom. And they knew this teacher had a little bit of a different perspective. So after 9 weeks spending time with Teacher B, this is what the report card looked like. Do you see any N's on there? They're all S's and I's. Now, Pollyannish teacher that just decided that we're going to look by all of the problems and not notice that there are any problems with this kid, or did she decide that she would gaze at this kid's strengths? And basically, that's what she decided to do. And it was remarkable in watching this kid over this 9 weeks. I'd go out once a week and visit and watch this kid by the name of Caden. Oh, sorry, Billy. you get to know him pretty well. And so we started looking at things differently and approaching this kid differently. We'll go to the next slide. This is what what the teacher would write to mom in the report cards. And she would write sometimes weekly, sometimes daily letters, just reporting the good things that this kid did. Billy Knowles, 27 out of 52 letters. He's excited about reading and makes connections. One time I was out there eating lunch in this cafeteria, and I have my sack lunch, and it has the word Wonder Bread on the sack. And Billy looks at me, and he says, "Wait right here." And then he runs off. Now, this school was different in that in a lot of schools, the teachers would have all stopped this kid and said, "You get back there, and you walk like you're supposed to." But they knew Billy was in a different place than a lot of kids, so they would let him run. So off he went, and then he comes back with this box of color crayons that has Wonder colors on it. And he says, "See, Wonder and Wonder." He notices his print. He notices everything, and that's part of his problem. He's so tactile, and that's where the neurological problems come in. One day I went out there to change the bean table to a sand table, so we had to take the beans out. I poured them into another bucket. Billy, he stands in the bucket and he says, "Pour, pour." So I'm pouring the beads over his head as they run into the bucket. Some fall outside the bucket. but he just loves all that tactile feel. I walked into the classroom one time, and he's rubbing his head on the carpet. And I get down by him, and I say, Billy, what are you doing? And he says, watch. And he takes his finger, and he puts it to my nose, and I get a shot. And he says, want to try? So I'm down there rubbing my head, and we're touching each other. You know? And this is the teacher that when he would come into the classroom, instead of getting all upset about the shoes being right in the middle of the door and making him line them up like all the other kids, she would just take her foot and just move them off to the side. She would say, that'll come later. But right now, I'm just glad that he's coming into the classroom. And the coat, he wouldn't swing it anymore, but he'd take it off just as he walked in, and there it would go, wherever. And again, she'd just move it off to the side. You know, that's hard with my German background, you know, to see that messiness. I like things, but you have to learn to look by some of that. You know about circle time with little kids and how they come in and have their circle time right away in the morning? Billy couldn't sit at circle time and was so disruptive that guess what she did? She dispensed with circle time for about 3 weeks and did different things. Eventually, they got back to circle time. Billy loves to respond during small group read aloud. He notices and focuses on everything on the page. He loves to investigate and explore pictures in print. Billy loves to retell if you take a mouse to the movies. As Billy trusts me more, I'm finding him listening and following directions as he's able. Billy has some focusing issues. It's not that he doesn't focus, but he focuses on everything. And he attends to everything around him. He notices his world. Now there's a positive spin, isn't it? The other teacher would have said he can't pay attention. No, he pays attention, but it's to everything. And his work is all about figuring out how not to pay attention to stuff that isn't really necessary. So we go on, and there's more stuff. We'll skip over that. Here's what's neat, folks. This is what Mom wrote back. I met Mom for the first time on a field trip, and I sat by her, and over the course of that program, she got up out of her seat 6 times. She had to go check on the car. She was afraid it was parked in the wrong spot. First time she came back and said, no, I think it's okay. 5 minutes later, she left, came back and said, no, I think it's in the wrong spot, but I don't have enough money to put in the meter. And it was like that the whole time. I don't know what's going on, but you know, clearly there's some issues there with Mom's stuff. But Mom wrote back at Christmas time, hope you have a great day again. You don't know how nice it is to have Billy go to school and not worry about how he's doing or how he is acting. It was funny, on Friday he wanted to call you to remind you of some sour worms. And I explained that he didn't have school on Saturday, and he said, aw, who made that rule? So he loves school, and it's because of you. We can't thank you enough. Now, again, I can't paint a Hollywood picture. This teacher was exhausted by the end of the school year. Just exhausted. And luckily, she was able to get help from a lot of people, because with a kid like this, you can't do it by yourself. So even the lunch aide, who really got upset with this kid, because every time he came through the lunch line, he would always go for the blue tray, and that meant he had to kind of sort through all of them, and she didn't like the fact that he was touching all of these. But this teacher B went to the lunch aide and said, we need your help. Here's what's going on with this kid. For some reason, he notices the blue trays, and that's what he likes. Guess what the lunch aide started to do? She would count 7 down, okay? She would stick the blue one 7 down, so that when he got there, there it was. And the janitor, everybody learned how to work with this kid. And it ended up creating a whole different way of being for this young person. He has some possibilities now. Now, there are professionals that are getting involved because he's got some neurological things going on. But at least he has a chance now.
It takes a village to raise a child, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. These were some practical tools to help him focus a little bit. You know, his day was so complicated in his own head that if they could focus on here's what you do now, here's what's going to happen next, and they did it in pictures, that was a way to keep track. Another tool that they used was kind of this neat little clock that's real quiet, but you turn it, and it's good with ADHD kids too, and it's good for all kids, really. When the teacher says, we're going to work, be serious learners for 20 minutes. I got the clock set, and that red slowly disappears. I could be reading, and Billy would be just paying attention. Loved the story. But when that time was up, I don't care if I was done or not, when we were getting to the punchline, he'd get up and just walk off and do his thing. But we had him for 10 minutes, you know, and he did well. Another tool that was used is this little disc down below here. When you sit on it, it's hard to sit on it straight because it's always moving. They've got some kind of lumps in there. So one way to help Billy sit at circle time was to put him on this thing, and he had to concentrate on sitting on that thing. That it caused him to sit still for a longer period of time. So there he is. He's doing really well, although he needs help, and but he loves school. Okay, you don't see Desmond Tutu's name down at the bottom, but I love this quote: "If we don't do all we can do to salvage these children, it's almost like spitting in the face of God." I don't necessarily like the word salvage because it gives the impression that these kids are garbage. None of them are. None of them are. I've never met a sociopath yet as a kid. Now, some claim they're out there. In fact, there's one author that I'm reading that says one out of every 25 of us is a sociopath. So that means someone in this group is a sociopath. But with kids, I just haven't met them. All of them have feelings and are capable of good things. I went on more than I wanted to, but I wanted to paint this picture that says that with these kids, that oftentimes the media, even our schools, will paint as disaster areas. If you're willing to stop being so darn judgmental, expand your circle a little bit, and to really focus on those strengths, it's powerful how that can transform people. It's absolutely powerful. And all of us can play a role in that, because all of us will run into those kids that push our buttons, and we want to shove them outside of our circles. Every family and every kid, we can find strength. Final comments before we get out of here. Thanks for your kind attention. Thank you.